listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2012 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. I know that I will read and reread Pico Iyer's beautiful new book, The Man Within My Head, loving its associative logic, its astute cultural commentary, and deep personal revelation, much as Pico Iyer has read and reread the novels of his literary mentor, Graham Greene. Reading Pico's book opens up my own writerly inner dialogue, as Graham serves Iyer as a way to access, as he writes, the undefended part of himself. Graham Greene became for Pico Iyer, as he said, a way to unlock his imagination. As Richard Rayner wrote in his perceptive Los Angeles Times book review of Iyer's book, this is a chronicle of an obsession. Iyer examines Greene as a shadow father, and this examination leads him into a deeper understanding of his relationship with his own father, the philosopher Raghavan Iyer. This is a book that is, like its author and like its inspiration, entirely original, making its restless way around the globe from Cuba to Bhutan to Sri Lanka to California in the 60s. Pico Iyer is the author of 2 novels and 7 works of nonfiction. He's been a writer for Time since 1982, and he frequently contributes to many publications, including the New York Times and magazines and newspapers on both sides of the Atlantic and the Pacific. He was born in Oxford, England, to Indian parents and grew up in California and currently lives in Japan. And as busy as Pico is with his many writing assignments, he is a great friend of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and this great library. He took the time during the recent Measure L campaign to write a really passionate piece, an op-ed piece for the Los Angeles Times about the need to support the Los Angeles Public Library. So his support really helped. And that's another reason why it would be a great, especially great tribute to Pico and to the series to become a Library Foundation member tonight, if you aren't already. It's my best pitch yet. Thank you. In conversation with Pico Iyer tonight, we have Thomas Kerwin. Always delighted to have Tom as an interlocutor. He's an award-winning staff writer at the Los Angeles Times, where he worked as the editor of the outdoors section, as a writer-at-large, and as an editor for the feature section, and as deputy editor of the Los Angeles Times book review. Remember when we really had a book review, when it was like a whole separate section? Great to remember. Tom is a recipient of several awards, the Academy of American Poets Prize, a Rosalind Carter Fellowship for Mental Health Journalism, and in 2008, he was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. His most recent pieces for the LA Times are poetic and hard-hitting narratives about a young Southern California woman studying to be an undertaker, about a family of embalmers in Louisiana. It's really quite extraordinary writing. We are so blessed to be able to read Tom's work in our own local newspaper. Please join me in welcoming Tom Kerwin and Pico Iyer to the LA Public Library.
Thank you.
Good evening. What a nice gathering here. Thank you for those very thoughtful words, Louise. I would just briefly second her comments and say that this Aloud series, I think, is one of the best occasions to stay late in downtown on a weeknight. And to support it through the foundation is a fantastic opportunity to tell people and let Louise and let the world know how important this is to you all. So, how are you, Pico? Nice
I'm
to just, see you.
I'm always so happy to be in this cathedral of books. I mean, this isn't a fundraising drive, but I think this is a national living treasure, and I'm always so glad that it sustains us in ways visible and invisible. Yeah. Also, I was happy somebody was cheering, so I think my mother must have stolen this hall.
I know, it's quite a reception here. So we're here to talk about The Man Within My Head. The last time we were here, we were talking about the Dalai Lama. And I guess that's the thing that made me think about how to start this interview was these writers that get underneath our skin, is how I'd put it, You and I were chatting earlier. I would say that Melville was perhaps one of my obsessions, and is the writer that's underneath my skin. I would also just tip a hat to Louise here. She's got a wonderful piece in the Los Angeles Review of Books on James Hillman, perhaps the person that's underneath her skin. And I'd probably suggest that all of us have a writer who's beneath our skin, someone that we just can't quite escape and the pull of and the intrigue and the obsession that we find ourselves when we think about this writer. So I think our challenge tonight is try to understand who Graham Greene is to you. Before we begin more specifically along those lines, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about this genre that you seem to have coined with the Dalai Lama book and now The Man Within My Head, this genre that you've called counterbiography. So I guess I'm kind of, it's a wonderful form, and it's produced a book that I think is far more intimate than I've read of yours, far more personal, and it's such a intriguing entree to another writer, to another person's life. Mm. Can you talk about its evolution a little bit and how you think about these books?
Yeah, it never struck me till you just brought the two books together. But I realize the book about the Dalai Lama could have been called The Man Within My Head, and this book could be called The Open Road. And I suppose they're, to some extent, interchangeable or shadow aspects of one another.
Right.
And you could say this book is a sequel to that, because I see both of them as compassionate realists. And I think what always strikes and moves me about the Dalai Lama is that he looks undeludedly, realistically at the world, and still has faith and confidence and believes that there's more possibility than we imagine. And Graham Greene, in a curious way, is about exactly the same thing, which some of you may not have read him, but if you haven't, you know his archetypal character is a so-called whiskey priest, a priest who gets drunk, who has mistresses, who does everything to violate the letter of Catholicism. And yet, in the crunch, when somebody is suffering, reaches out his hand or performs a mass for a dying woman or does something that transcends himself so that he seems actually more heroic than the most pious priest. And I feel with Graham Greene that he really was always taking the measure of the world, but yet never giving up on hope. And so maybe I hadn't really thought of it until you asked it, but these are part of the same kind of inquiry. And when I said counterbiography, I was probably trying to get around the fact that they don't fit into any genre. I mean, this isn't a memoir, it's not a biography, it's not quite a work of nonfiction, it's not really a work of fiction. I deliberately took out, a year before I'd finished it, I had a full ponderous subtitle explaining what the book was about. And then 6 months before I finished it, I reduced it to just an inquiry. And then 1 week before I sent it off, I took that out entirely so that this thing would kind of hover in some unclaimed space in your head and you wouldn't know really what to do with it. And I think one reason I'm writing these ever more bizarre, eccentric books is that I think writing has to do something pretty remarkable to justify its existence in the world. And if somebody here in this room is interested in Graham Greene, they could probably go back home and listen to him on the internet and access images of him and get all the wisdom that's ever been collected about Graham Greene in their own homes. So how can you possibly rationalize writing a book? And I think the only way is by writing a book that somehow touches those spaces inside ourselves of nuance or silence or the places between the words or of feelings that you can't articulate, to get to those spaces that no camera or internet or exciting multimedia device can touch. So that's why I'm trying not to fit into any of the categories, maybe.
And I guess that's what I find is so compelling about these two books, and this one in particular, is that it does sort of give us a chance to look at how you approach literature in some manner. I mean, I've always picked up a book and tried to view it as a toolbox of some sort that allows me that gives me various tools to help me understand my own life, to understand my own psyche and the questions that I have about the world and how to go about the world. Yeah. And clearly Graham Greene, you discovered, was that person. Your discovery of Graham Greene was a little, not quite sort of immediate. It was sort of, he sort of sat in the back of your head for a while before he came on the stage.
Yes. For one fatal reason, which is we were made and forced to read him in school. So he was everything I wanted to run away from. He was the set reading when we were 12 years old and 14 years old, and our teachers were convinced that, exactly as you said, he was the way that we'd learn how to be a good person or how to observe certain of the schoolboy verities or whatever. So, yeah, I wanted to have nothing to do with Graham Greene until I began traveling. And I think anyone who travels quickly finds that Graham Greene is almost the patron saint of the foreigner alone in a hotel room in a country that he doesn't understand, not knowing whom to trust, not knowing whether he's going to last the day, terrified and fascinated at the same time. And he still gets that better than anyone. And I love the fact that this title made you start to think about who was in your head and why. Yeah. Because I think everybody in this room, everybody alive, has these, it could be an actor or a singer or a painter, somebody from history, and somehow we feel as if they understand us better than our own friends and family do. And what exactly is going on, and why this person and not that one? And in fact, there are other writers who are probably closer to my heart than Graham Greene. My friends are tired of my going on and on for 25 years about how much I love Emerson and Thoreau. Melville, who I think is your person, is my person because he's stalking the unlit passageways of my being night and day. He's a restless ghost. I can't get him out of my system. I'm fascinated by Leonard Cohen, with the great laureate of Los Angeles, with whom I've identified very strongly for about 40 years. And I, at one point, had 15, 20 pages in this book about Leonard Cohen and Graham Greene and all the correspondences between them, which seemed even more clearly to explain to me what it was in these difficult, elusive characters that were speaking to me, though I took those pages out. So there are many others. I took out 2,760 pages. I don't know if I... I wish that was an exaggeration. I wrote 3,000 pages to generate this tiny, tiny book. And when I first wrote this book, it was entirely fiction. There were 40 sketches about Graham Greene. I imagined him in places he'd never been. I created school friends reminiscing about the boy Graham Greene. I took the aunt from Travels and My Aunt, and I had her lead his fictional self around Thailand and other places.
How fascinating.
And then I cut those down to 4, and the book was a hybrid between fiction and nonfiction. And I thought it would be interesting to see what sparks could be set up between the obviously fictional projected Greene that I create in my head and some version of a real Greene. Then I went down to 1 story at the beginning to kind of do what Greene does and what the world does, which is keep us on edge and not encourage us to suspect we know what's going to happen next, mm-hmm. and keep us on alert. And then finally, in the last edit, I got rid of even that last piece of fiction. Leonard Cohen, there was a Freudian slip, Leonard Greene. Leonard Greene and Graham Cohen are both in this huge stack of pages in the closet that will probably never see the light of day.
It's so interesting. I guess I find myself attracted to books of this sort because I'm seeing, I think we're all seeing more and more of these writers that are sort of pushing genres mm-hmm. and not being so content with writing just strict fiction or strict nonfiction, mm-hmm. but trying to think about the world in ways that blur. I think W.S. Sebald, for one, is a good example of this novelist whose work enters sort of this wonderful sort of realm of nonfiction, mm-hmm. although we're told it's fiction, although we can't really quite be sure. So after you took these 3,000 pages and distilled them down, so it allows me to ask the question. You divided this book into 3 parts. Mm-hmm. It's ghosts, it's gods, and it's fathers.
Yeah.
Did that division come near the end of the revisions, or was that just, is that how you initially saw? Because I guess those 3 divisions highlight the 3 sort of questions that you'd hope to resolve in your mind by writing this book.
Well, you just explained it more clearly to myself than I could to you. That's wonderfully said. And it sounds treacherously close to Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, doesn't it, when I hear it said like that? The 3 sections came in quite towards the end of the process. But every one of my books has an odd number of sections. It's sometimes 5, it's sometimes 7, sometimes 13. I think a couple have had 3, partly to keep you off balance again. Rather than the sometimes artificial roundedness of 2 or 4 or 6, I always deal in those, I suppose, to try and bring a weird kind of energy into them. The last book I wrote, like this, called Sun After Dark, also had 3 sections. Mm-hmm. But it was very much at the end of things, and you could actually call the section called God, Fathers, or Ghosts. I mean, to some extent, they're arbitrary and interchangeable. It is about 3 characters as represented on the cover. Right. And it probably is 3 genres. Now you mentioned it. You mentioned W.G. Sebald. And what I loved about him was when you open the cover of his book and where it specifies a genre, it would often say fiction, nonfiction,
that's
history.
Right, that's right.
And I remember once, actually at the Festival of Books, where I have seen you sometimes, I said on stage, W.J. Zabolt has written the best nonfiction book I've read in years. And that very same weekend, it won the L.A. Times Prize for the best fiction of the year.
Right, you're right.
As it's an inquiry, it doesn't really matter. I think that those terms are arbitrary. And, you know, one thing I'm so fascinated about by Green, and one affinity I feel for him, is that he did everything he could to live outside categories, as I have done, and to live outside any definition somebody would try to contain him in or imprison him in. So he was ostensibly a Catholic, but he didn't believe in God. He was the most English person you could imagine. He spent all his life in flight from England. He wrote memoirs that wonderfully avoided telling you anything about himself, a bit like this book, actually. But as Louise was saying in her introduction, as somebody born to Indian parents in England and then moving to California, I've never felt comfortable in categories. And if anything is prompting me towards them, I will do everything I can to jump out.
Yeah, and I guess as you talk about Green and your affinities with him, it gets sort of to the heart of this conversation. There's a point in the book where you write about Green and from your perspective, and I guess that's what I found so interesting here is Green, you know, who wrote these sort of parables of the damned. So interesting that you read them in school, as I did too. Now that I think about it, because they are stories that aren't quite clear aphorisms on how to behave. I mean, these characters have troubles, but at first blush, Green seems a little bit different from you. As you write, describing yourself, I believe here, a scruffy mongrel living in Japan who can feel that his deepest life story is being told by an Englishman of two generations before whose agonies don't always move him. Mm. Well, 250 pages later, obviously those agonies do move you. If not because of country, then faith. If not because of faith, then as a writer and a traveler. You find yourself on the outside more than on the inside. That fuels your writing.
It's beautifully said, yes. And I love what you said about parables of the damned, because I do think of his books as allegories in some sense. Mm-hmm. And they're almost about something as simple as a man walking down a foreign street and a stranger coming up to him with a hand extended and wondering what to do with that challenge. And of course, we confront those kind of things every day here in Los Angeles or at home, but it's so easy to sleepwalk past them. But when you're in a foreign setting and everything is dramatized and distilled in some ways, you can't dodge the moral and emotional riddles that the challenges that life brings to you. So parenthetically, I love that phrase that you used. In answer to what we have in common or why his anguishes move me, I did begin from the fact that constantly, wherever I went, it seemed as if I was stumbling through one of his novels, to the point I almost felt I'm a figment of his imagination, or he is actually scripting my life. And I could speak for the next 16 hours on the correspondences between us, whether it's the fact that I would read a biography of him and he would be praying or confessing to her father, Pilkington. I would remember that the man responsible for my spiritual welfare when I was a boy, my housemaster at school, was a priest with the not common name of Father Pilkington. I chose the perfect summary for the Dalai Lama's thinking, as you mentioned, and just after that I opened a Graham Greene book. There was the same quote from Hamlet in the epigraph. I found an obscure 17th century work of French theology, and I wrote a whole novel about it, and later I found Greene telling somebody at a lunch table that that was the most transforming, life-changing book he had ever encountered. Whether tiny things or big things, all kinds of correspondences. I was born in the same street in Oxford, next to which he had lived. I was born in the same hospital where his daughter was born. I went to the same elementary school where his son went. But ultimately, I saw none of that was really material. And that, as you say, the fundamental correspondence was something much more invisible and perhaps mysterious. And any reason I could give for why I feel a kinship with him, I wouldn't believe. Because I think the power of affinity lies in the fact that it lies outside the explicable. And that I will look across a room like this and see somebody in the second to last row and somehow feel as if I know her better than I know you or my friends and family. Right. I think Green had a fundamental sense that the most important things in life, by definition, were the ones you could never explain, whether it was love or faith or terror, maybe. But that they were much larger than our explanations. And he lived in the presence of immensities. And I liked what you said in the question about how, you're right, as a schoolboy text, he's teaching us what not to do.
Right.
But he's also teaching us what to do even in the midst of our acknowledgement of our confusions and sins. And so many holy books start at a very high level. They tell us, you know, love others, as you know, do unto others as you would that they do unto you. Things I'm mangling, but you get the point. Whereas he starts from the fact that we're all confused, blundering, sinning human beings, but nonetheless can actually rise to moments of kindness or selflessness that surprise even ourselves. And that's not a bad thing for a schoolboy to learn. Of course, when we were schoolboys, we were too young to appreciate that. But now, when you and I think back on it, I see there was a certain wisdom to them saying, you're all truants, delinquents, breaking every rule in the school. But don't worry, heaven is not close to you.
It's interesting. As I was reading this book, I was reminded when I was, as Louise mentioned, I did this story about these embalmers in Louisiana, a very Catholic group of individuals, and they were taking care of a case, as they refer to it euphemistically, of a little boy that had been terribly murdered. And as I was talking to them, they were always talking about, well, if you believe in God, then you have to believe in the devil. Mm-hmm. And what was interesting from that was that they went from the top down. Mm-hmm. Believe in God, then there has to be evil. Green, and every time that you approach that sentiment in this book, it was always believing in the devil, well, then there has to be a God up above. So he was sort of taking it in the other direction, as if it was far more easy to reconcile yourself to the presence of evil or disappointment or devils or the darker side in order to see and then be able to construe the possibility of there being something other than that.
Exactly. And then conversely, I think many people love the fact when priests or holy men do something wrong, and we can see, well, they're not as good as they pretended. Whereas Green again started the other side and took the most obvious sinner and showed he's not as bad as even he imagines. Mm-hmm. And in a curious way, yes, he always came to faith through the back door, but it was a very earned entrance there. He took nothing on trust.
Is it ever really faith, though?
Yes, towards the end of his life, he would sometimes say that he had faith but not belief. He had the emotional longing to surrender and to believe there was an order in the world, but he could never come rationally to it. One of the most moving things, though I don't think I included it in the book, it's in those 2,700 pages, is that he could never bear to go and see a movie with a happy ending because he so wished that it couldn't come true and he so felt it never could come true. And so that speaks for really the core of him, which is over and over he says things like, I longed for permanence, but I could never find it. Or I believed in goodness, but I knew it was never inside me. And those are the things Melville might almost have said also.
Well, this is what I find interesting, too, is just the sense that how do you live as an outsider? How do you reconcile? I mean, this is where the book's all about, Green's tolerance of paradox, Green's tolerance of not knowing, his ability to live. I mean, I was thinking about Keats's negative capability. I mean, that sense that you can, you don't have to be searching for the definitive answers, and you can live with the ambiguities, as we were talking about earlier. How do you live with that outsiderness when part of you rushes to belong and to have a community and to have a place to... a home, and yet never really having that home?
It's easier if you don't want to belong. And I think he never wanted to belong. I probably never want to belong. And it's easier if you find the questions much more interesting and alive and dynamic than the answers. So just as you said so wonderfully, he loved living inside and around questions because they were inexhaustible and they were larger than he was, and he never could entertain the illusion that he was on top of things or that he had a full command of things. And if you have an answer, that's a kind of fixity, and a fixity is a kind of death. So I can see the allure of all of that. And I think one of the things that so moves me about him is partly that he put kindness before belief. And in that regard, he's a little like the Dalai Lama, whose most recent book is called Beyond Religion, and who, as the world's most visible Buddhist, not only tells people in Los Angeles, please don't become a Buddhist, but even in his new book says it doesn't matter if you have a religion or not. That's kind of a luxury. The most important thing is what kindness and responsibility you bring to the people around you. And I think with Green, he often felt, doesn't matter what you say you believe or don't believe, you have the chance for compassion right now. Mm-hmm. And that's essentially how you define yourself, and maybe that's even how the Catholic Church should or would ultimately define you. So that's one thing I like about him. The other is that he was unsparingly honest and tough about himself, and very, very kind towards other people. And in some ways, what I get from his books is an explosion of the whole notion of enmity, whether we're thinking about Iran right now, or the guy who's just given us a bad review, or the brother we've never got on with. Greene, the only unsympathetic people in his books are the ones who resemble Graham Greene. Towards everybody else, he brings what every novelist longs to bring, which is sympathy and understanding. So you always see the world through the eyes of the person you're opposed to. And that's a very interesting thing, especially, you know, sometimes I think we're living in an ever more polarized country right. and world. And we're ever more stuck within and comfortable with our own assumptions. And so for somebody always to be playing devil's advocate and always to be turning us on our heads, I think it's quite a fruitful thing. So
let's go back to what you said earlier about the impulse of not wanting to belong.
Yeah.
Where does that come from? Where does that come from in you, for instance? I don't get the impression that you're a misanthrope. I don't get the impression that you sort of disdain the society of man. I mean, right. you're out and about and charming and gregarious soul. So how do you reconcile the fact that you don't? What is it that you don't want to belong to?
A group or a category, as I said before. And I think it's really my second nature because I grew up really in a state of movement. A lot of this book is about how, from the time I was 9 years old, I went back and forth 6 times a year between my parents' house in Santa Barbara in the California of the 60s that most of you remember, when the students down the road were burning down the Bank of America and razing to the ground the foundations of life as we knew it. Between that and Graham Greene's world, which is a boarding school set up in the year 1440, where we wore full morning dress to class every day and wrote poems in dead languages. And so I quickly thought, well, I clearly don't belong fully to England, and I don't belong fully to California, and I've never lived in India. Where I live is in the movement, the friction, the discussion between these places. It's in the passage between them. It's in the constant going back and forth between seeing England through sometimes Californian eyes, as I did as a little boy, and California through English eyes. Between going to England and telling all my envious friends there I'd spent the summer on Telegraph Avenue listening to the Grateful Dead, and coming back to Santa Barbara and reciting the Lord's Prayer in Latin and confounding my friends there. But in other words, the state of movement and not belonging is my home. Foreignness is what I'm used to, and so that's probably the reason I live in the most alien society I can think of, Japan, where I'll always be a foreigner. But that suits me. It doesn't, of course, suit everybody.
Yeah, and that's interesting. I mean, you and I earlier were talking about Melville, and I always read Melville and get a sense of this man, this writer, as being sadly not a part of the world, as someone who wished he could find a way to find a place in the world for himself and never... And sort of despondent over that fact.
Yes.
Greene, I get the impression, is someone perhaps much like you, who is finds it far more easy to circulate in the world and to be in that in-between space.
Yes, and I think Greene always felt he had to create his home within himself. Mm-hmm. That home was a portable thing. Home was not connected to a piece of soil. It was much more connected to a piece of soul. Home was an ongoing, lifelong project, a work in progress, constantly being revised, but really had to do with what belonged to him, what he cared for, what he believed in, what was closest to his heart. That would be his home. And I think, actually, in the first chapter of this book, I suddenly heard or saw myself saying, home is a temporary tent you build on a vast open plain. Right. And I don't know if I believe it, but when I listened to your question, I thought, well, maybe that's what he was doing and I'm doing, making a series of temporary homes and being happy with that and more comfortable with that than permanent homes. Right. He was married for the last 63 years of his life, roughly, but 40 of those years he lived alone. So even a domestic environment was too much for him. And I often think in relation to your question, and when I began writing, I used to think about V.S. Naipaul. Are similarly displaced, constantly traveling around the world and feeling estranged everywhere. And I thought, well, actually, I, coming out of a similar background, could travel around the world and feel similarly at home everywhere.
Right.
And when I go to Paraguay or Ethiopia or Yemen, those places at some level are no more foreign to me than California or England or India. And actually, I've been given a great blessing. So I suppose I'm a bit of a glass half full kind of person. And the predicament or the situation that you describe, I see as something that's opened lots of doors for me or for Greene, even as it's closing others. Whereas I think there are others like Melville who are poignantly standing outside the locked door, staring into the window right. at a peace that will never be theirs. And Greene had a lot of that, and I probably don't. but I'm certainly standing in the same position outside the door as he, even though with a different emotion.
Now, of course, that doesn't mean, I mean, 60 years of marriage to his wife and three mistresses that we know of. You describe a part of your book that I thought was quite interesting when you discovered his love letters.
Yes.
I mean, it's not like this guy was just sort of happily removed from the world. I mean, this is a man who had deep passions for these women. Just describe that. I mean, I thought it was really interesting because it's sort of it's a counterpoint of sorts to that person of the world.
Yes,
that person that has such strongly, deeply romantic feelings towards these women.
Yes, and because I always love the fact that Green came across as a very veiled, guarded, wary person, a typically gracious, courteous, but removed middle-class Englishman in life. And I'd always imagined that was all a front, a cover for somebody much more passionate. And only 3 years after his death, in the second volume of his official biography, did his biographer excavate and make public the love letters that Green had written in his 40s to his American mistress. And just as you were saying, they're the most torrential, volcanic, passionate, fiery Lorentzian letters you could see. And suddenly I felt vindicated. There's the Green I believed in all along, that in his letters, privately to somebody he really cared about, he could come out from behind the mask and show a real ardor and tenderness and sympathy. So I was getting very excited when I read those love letters in volume 2 of the biography. So excited, I went back to volume 1 of the biography describing his early years. And there, when he was 23 and he met the young woman who was going to be his wife, again, a torrent of letters, almost word for word the same as the letters he wrote 25 years later to his mistress. He sent his young, bewildered 19-year-old fiancée 2,000 letters in 2 years, sometimes 3 letters a day, just a bombardment. And so when I saw that, I began to wonder how much was this the artist knowing at an early age how to use words for his own designs, and how much was this man literally in the possession of his emotions? And I couldn't answer that to that this day. But then I had to ask, well, as somebody who allies himself with Graham Greene and feels such a kinship, what does it say about me when I'm writing letters? How much am I in love with the writing, and how much am I in love with the fact of intoxication, and how much am I really venturing my heart? And again, I couldn't answer that question, but it's a good and salutary one to ask, I thought. So again, Green had suddenly opened a door to some chamber inside myself that I'd rather not open, but I probably am the better for looking at.
It's interesting. I mean, you wrote Green a letter, and he wrote you back a very brief statement saying, you know, not now, thank you. Richard Rayner, in his review, as Louise cited, a very nice review of the book, commented on the fact that had he written you back, would you have written this book?
Yeah, that's right. Had he written me back, I'd have been terrified. And a large part of me was
written
relieved.
You back more fulsomely.
Well, had he said yes.
Yes, yes.
I'd have been really thrown off, because I'm keenly aware, as you are as a writer, and probably everyone in this room is as a reader and writer, that every writer has at least two human beings. There's the one who's talking on a stage and interacting with the world and having to help the smooth onward movement of society. And there's the one who's unrecognizable even to himself at his desk, lost in some private wilderness inside his imagination. And I know if I'm writing, working on one of my books, and my wife suddenly comes into the room, I suddenly rise to the surface of myself and become a different person. Mm. And I have to make conversation. And so for that reason, I've increasingly never really sought out a writer that I admire, partly because if I were to meet Graham Greene, I would be distracted by the color in his face and his high voice and the drink that he was offering me and the small talk that he was making. And all of that would complicate and in fact distract from the real person who's speaking to my soul on the page. And I feel I can have a much deeper interaction with that invisible, bodiless Green that I meet in book after book, who's right. Whispering his most intimate secrets and terrors to me, than I could ever have with a person in the world. So a writer is fundamentally speaking to us from a very private place. So to meet him publicly, you can't begin to touch the person who so fascinates you. When I wrote that letter to him, I was in my late 20s, and a part of me thought it was so fun to go and meet these people before whom I want to bow. But I really wasn't disappointed when he said no. He was already 84 years old, and he only had 2 more years to live. And Richard was inspired in that comment, because the Green would suddenly have gone from some very deep, mysterious place in me to much more the surface of myself.
And I do think that in every writer there is a degree of unrequited love. I mean, or in all our lives, let's put it that way. Yeah. It's unrequited love that drives us to faith or belief, if we're lucky. It's unrequited love that drives us towards the book that we hope someday to write. Speaking of myself, the perfect story, the sense that there's always something a little bit more that you can be reaching for.
Yes, thank you. And unrequited love also raises the possibility that if I'd met Green, he would have disliked me intensely and closed the door on me. And then what would I do?
A whole new type of obsession would have.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, one of the things that really interests me, which is the reason I wrote this book, was confirmed as I was writing it. I noticed that 7-8 other books have been written by men and women who somehow feel that Graham Greene has possessed them. And as you said in your introduction, got under their skin, got into their soul. Some of them see him as almost diabolical. Others see him, as I do, as a benign figure. But there's something about him. During his life, contemporaries such as George Orwell or Aldous Huxley or Evelyn Waugh were probably more highly regarded than Greene. But none of them somehow had the capacity of getting into your head and taking root there. He had a great gift for intimacy on the page. And it's startling when you read many of these books. There's one by somebody called Alan Judd, a novel, short novel, in which a young man writes a review, and he suddenly gets a letter from Green, the mysterious recluse in south of France, inviting him down. And like myself, in my late 20s, he eagerly heads there, keen to meet his hero. And as soon as he does, this rather sepulchral, ghostly figure hands him his last manuscript, dies, and this young man suddenly becomes Graham Greene. He lives in his house, he takes over his young mistress, and as he's writing, he always hears a phantom pen scribbling in the distance. I include in this book a version of what Teresa of Avila said, which is, answered prayers are God's curses. Answered prayers are exactly what make our life a misery. And so in this case, the young man who's always dreamed of meeting Graham Greene meets him and then gets so occupied by him that his own self vanishes forever. That could have happened to me too. But it's interesting, why does he cast the spell in this way? It's like the Sphinx sitting in the desert of our consciousness, and we're magnetically drawn to him, but we don't know what to do with that phantom in our head.
Right. To go back a little bit on what you're talking about, there's a point in this book where you do talk about what it means to be a writer. You talk about how you, at your desk, you're writing, your wife walks in, and you come up to a different level. I love this sentence. You write, "So much of writing is a performance, a design or presentation aimed to charm or divert or persuade. The great challenge of the desk is to push past every agenda and self-consciousness to whatever lies beneath." And I guess that's what Green was able to do, was able to get beneath all of that. How do you get beneath all of that?
By writing and writing and writing those 3,000 pages till I have just 240 that I can trust and I feel belong as much to the soul as to the personality in some ways. In other words, I'm not a performance and not aimed at charming or beguiling or persuading, but secrets I'm whispering from one part of me to another. And that really takes a long time. And I think in deference to Green, I spent 8 years writing this very small book. And I was waiting and waiting and waiting at my desk in rural Japan for those moments to come up in me that, from my own experience, that told my story, but also told a much bigger story. Because it's funny, I was sitting in this very chair 9 months ago talking to Colin Thubron, the great English writer who went to the same high school as I did, and came out of the same background and was trained in classical England that one thing you should never write about is yourself. And Colin pushed past that a little in his last book, but there's still a great deal of diffidence. He included a little about his father, but then by most people's standards, very little because of that training. And so I similarly was thinking, I can only tell my story if somehow it speaks for something very archetypal. So, for example, I took great pains that the book would begin in the city of La Paz, Bolivia, so that it would begin in peace, which Graham Greene called the most beautiful word in the English language. And I took great pains to end the book very close to La Paz, so we're ending near peace. It begins with almost what you could call a near-birth experience and ends with a near-death experience. Right. And so while giving some of the details of my life, I was trying to catch almost an allegory, as in Greene, about the arc of a human life, removed from particulars, but having to do with, as you said so well, love and faith and the mysteries of the subconscious. That sounds a bit portentous, but those many things that we can't understand in everyday life.
But that's the experience of the book too. In some ways, writing about green allows you to write. I get the impression allowed you to write more about yourself.
Yeah.
So that suddenly we are learning about your relationship to your father, and we are seeing a son dealing with his father's passing. We are suddenly seeing you watching the flames hit your house above Santa Barbara. Mm-hmm. We are suddenly seeing you cast in a city, disoriented, this sort of hallucinogenic world of travel that puts you in the middle of nowhere, meeting people that you, in a very Graham Greene sort of way, that you never thought you would meet, but who have somehow make a huge effect upon your life.
Yes.
This is why I think this counter biography mm-hmm. is such an interesting approach to trying to understand the novelist Graham Greene and his writing and his world.
Yes, because I think if you were to ask me write about Pico Iyer, I would give you two words.
Right.
But if you were to ask me write about the Central Library and why you love it, as I did last year, I would give you a lot of words, and they will actually reveal something very fundamental about me. So exactly so. Give somebody, especially somebody born in England, give them a cover, and they will be very intimate.
Yeah, it's interesting. As I was preparing, so I take notes as I prepare for these things, and there's a point where in the book you're left to wonder what Graham Greene's wound is. Mm. And it's doubt, mm-hmm. and so I'm thinking to myself, well, what's Pico Iyer's wound?
Yeah, well, that question is asked expressly.
Please.
In the book, and I say detachment and not being good at settling down to things. So you're right, and I also think that it's very hard really to take stock of oneself if you just sit down and say, I'm going to investigate the crevices within
right.
myself. But as soon as you can see yourself reflected in somebody else, then you can it's externalized, and you can really deal with it and take it on. And it may be a projected other. In other words, what I'm writing here may have very little to do with the real Graham Greene, but I have constructed a Graham Greene who will help me to look at certain tendencies in myself that I wouldn't be able to just by scrutinizing my
neighbor. And that's because it is a selective Graham Greene that's in this book.
Yes, it
this
is.
This is not. This isn't the communist. This isn't the spy. This isn't the alcoholic. This
yes,
isn't the.
Yes.
This is a Graham Greene that suits you.
Yes.
And someone is a foil for your own questions about yourself.
Yes.
It's interesting, we say wound, and I think to myself, what a it's sort of a pejorative word, when really it is that aspect of your psyche that and Graham Greene's psyche that leads to these creations and these inquiries and that we all sort of benefit from.
Yes, and I think one of the things that was so fascinating and unique about Greene was that when he was 16, he tried to run away from his school, partly because his father was the headmaster there, and he failed, but his parents, astonishingly, for middle-class England in 1920, sent him for 6 months to live with a wild Jungian dream analyst and a dream analyst's dangerously glamorous wife. And so instantly, that opened the door for Greene to the sense of the shadow, parallel, subconscious universe. And in book after book, until his final novel, which he published when he was 84, he describes a boy walking away from the daylight, upstanding official world and self, and literally descending into an underground run by a charming, colorful, and somewhat crooked man and his mole. And I think living for 6 months with a Jungian when you're 16 essentially tells you that the wound is more important than the achievement.
Mm.
And so even as his friends at school were busy being trained to go out and administer the English Empire, he was learning about the private world, the unsettledness, what dreams set going in us, everything that doesn't fit into the official program and in fact subverts it and shows us how imperfect we are and how unable we are to administer the world. So I think, just as you said, woundedness was his subject from the beginning, even though his classmates and his upbringing had set him up to be the man of confidence and an interesting... interesting aspect.
Yeah.
And I think he always had a keen sense, maybe because of the Jungian, of how writing and dreaming are more or less the same thing. And the way that you will dream today about an event and a year later it happens. And the same thing happened in his writing. He would describe a dead woman found in a British railway station in 1934. 4 months later, a dead woman was found in a British railway station. He would dream at night about a ship going down in the Irish Sea, 5 days later, he would find that as he was dreaming, a ship was going down in the Irish Sea. And I know, as a writer...
It's pretty uncanny.
It is, but I think every writer knows that sensation, yeah, that somehow you're tapping something that's connected with the future, not the past. And whether you're an accomplished writer like Green or a less accomplished writer like the rest of us, you're swimming in these interesting waters. I remember I once wrote a book about a couple, and it was quite similar to a couple in real life. And I ended my book with the couple apart, even though they were very close in real life. And the minute the advance galleys arrived on my doorstep, they separated. I thought, what have I set loose? What little whim of the imagination have I put into play only in my book that has somehow cast a kind of hex on them? And every writer, I think, knows variations on that story and therefore defers to the power of the subconscious and therefore, as you said earlier, can't discount things like the devil and therefore can't discount things like God. Writing itself makes you aware of all these forces around you that you can't begin to control, but that you have to pay due respect to.
That's lovely. That's very well put. At this point, you had a reading that you'd like to.
I did, and let me read just one passage.
I'd love that. Yeah, a way of sort of reminding us of the writer here, as opposed to the interlocutor.
Yes. Let's see. So I mentioned a few of the correspondences I have with Green before. And one of them was that all his life, he had this mysterious terror of seeing his house burn down, which is a curious fear for a boy growing up in quiet suburban England. But lo and behold, when he was in his 30s, during the Blitz in World War II, German bombs hit his house and it was reduced to ash. One day when I was in my 30s, I was walking up my parents' staircase in Santa Barbara, California, and I suddenly saw we were surrounded by 70-foot flames. And 3 hours later, a Californian wildfire, which all of you know a lot about, had reduced the house and everything in it except for me to ash. And I began to think, these correspondences with Green aren't quite as amusing or diverting as I had imagined. And we rebuilt our house on the same property because we were told that the brush would take 30 years to grow back. But a few years later, we were encircled by fires again, and then again, and then again. And I write about the fires in this book, partly, as I said before, because they're real-life events that made an impact on me, but partly because they seem to catch a sort of metaphorical truth. Because for Buddhists, of course, and for Christian mystics, all of life is a burning house. There were fires raging all across the hills around our house, and I was sitting in a downtown restaurant with my mother and my wife, Hiroko. I'd flown into Santa Barbara 2 days before, and driving along the empty road that leads from the airport to our house 10 minutes away, I'd looked up into the hills to where the lights of our home shine alone on our ridge, and my heart had stopped. There were two bright blazes of orange cutting through the darkness with a speed and efficiency I remembered from the time when our home in the same location had burnt down with me beside it some years before. I accelerated wildly up the hill and started taking the curves along the mountain road leading up to our solitary house at a crazy speed. The air to the north was already red and full of smoke, and as I pushed the car to go faster, I saw sightseers along the side of the road gathering to watch the unearthly light show, great towers of orange 100 feet high rising from the valleys just below our home and smoke turning the sky into a sickly pall. I swerved, brakes screaming, into our driveway and summoned my wife and mother out to see what was happening a mile or two away. It looked to be remote still, but I remembered how during the previous fire the flames had raced through the brush at 70 miles an hour, so that an orange gash in what looked to be a distant slope was suddenly a pillar of flames arcing over our living room windows. The next day, we awoke to the sound of helicopters whirring overhead. The sky was a grisly blood-red color. The house felt hot already, and although the smoke seemed to clear as the wind shifted and returned us to a placid blue midsummer day, as the afternoon went on, the sky above the ridge next to us turned a hideous end-of-the-world color, or discolor, really, ash falling around us like snow. I went with Hiroko down to the post office, and as we came out after a short transaction, the whole suburb around us was black with coffee smoke. We looked up to the hills, to where our house and our far-off neighbors were, and all we could see were 1, 2, 3 slashes of orange angrily starting up across the slopes. We began to drive home, and switching on the radio, I heard that our house and the few up the road had been issued an evacuation warning. I turned into our little road and began driving up it, and the announcer on the local radio, frantic, said that the evacuation warning had been turned into an order. We had to leave now, or we would be forced out. We drove the remaining 5 minutes at a crazy speed again, collected my mother, her dazed cat, inside a little cage, gathered as many precious papers and photos as we could in 5 minutes, and then tore down the road again, fire trucks coming past us in the opposite direction, plumes of smoke seeming to rise from all the valleys and the crevices in the hills, the air so thick we were choking already, and driving out of what seemed to be an oven, the huge flames cresting above our house as if ready to engulf it. Probably a good time to end. Then people are moved to see what happens.
I think what attracted me to that sequence and my notes here, a fire plays a large portion of this book, and, mm-hmm. and you have a wonderful sentence just about how our destinies can unravel these even as we're writing them. Mm-hmm. And just a sense of how these books help prepare us for what we don't know that lies ahead of us.
Yes, and you said something beautiful earlier about not knowing. Mm-hmm. And somebody just 3 days ago, out of the blue, as we were walking through Golden Gate Park, said, not knowing is a form of intimacy. Mm. Not knowing is more intimate than any form of knowledge could be. And we're in a state of not knowing with our wives or the people that we know best, probably. Yeah. That's not such a bad place to be. So if books like Graham Greene's prepare us for that, they're really doing us a great service. I loved what you said about the toolbox, and that's one of the most critical tools we can have, is preparing us for what to do with what we don't know or can't control.
Wonderful. Well, at this point, not knowing is not good enough for me. I would like to know what your questions are for Pico. I believe that there is a mic that's going to be passed around, so please keep your questions succinct. We'd like to get to as many people as possible in the next 15 minutes or so.
Hello, Pico. Thank you for being here. My question relates to, I have a particular person in my head, and I'm just wondering because you know you study Buddhism and stuff, if you've possibly ever explored a character who might feel they might be the continuation or the reincarnation of somebody that was known before, and how they deal with that, if they become aware of that, or if they're maybe just drawing off that character's spirit essence that's in that timeless, spaceless realm, and the dichotomies of trying to come to grips with why are you so in tuned and connected? Why are there so many synchronicities, coincidences, premonitions with you and this previously known artist?
Yeah, I think a lot of the affinities we feel are with people no longer alive, many of them in distant past. You mentioned Melville in your case. Graham Greene has been dead for 20 years, and I feel closer to him than ever. And I think it's a bit like déjà vu. I often ask myself, why do I feel I recognize the eastern hills of Kyoto more deeply than the house where I was born or the place where I lived for many years in Santa Barbara? And it's mysterious. My mother would roll her eyes and say, well, you were Japanese in a past life. And maybe that's it, or maybe it's something else. And of course, I did spend a lot of time with the Dalai Lama, who is officially a reincarnation of 13 others before him. And sometimes people ask him, do you ever think about your earlier reincarnations? And he says, well, I could, but I don't know how much use there would be in it. He feels a very strong kinship with two of the earlier Dalai Lamas, but I think he always feels, well, the most important thing is what can he do tomorrow rather than what might have happened to him in the past. So I think when we talk about mystery, we probably are talking about connections across time as well as across space. But I'm happy to leave the mystery intact.
Mystery's a great motivator.
Yes. I hope this is not too tangential, but could you comment something about your own experiences as a writer and now as a human being in Japan vis-a-vis Lafcadio O'Hearn?
Wonderful question, thank you. And of course, Lafcadio Hearn was the master of the ghost stories and probably felt and lived the power of Japanese ghosts more potently than a Japanese person might because of the foreign distance. He was also one of many foreigners who had that very vexed love-hate relationship with the country, unrequited love, what was going on there, because he was in love with Japan, but Japan was never fully in love with him. And that's the state of many of us who go as votaries and pilgrims to that place. So I was just talking, I mean, it's one of the wonderful things about Japan, which I don't always feel in the California I know, is that it's thick with ghosts. And they have so keen a sense of history that if I go to an old hotel with my wife, she will be unable to sleep the whole night because she can feel all the other people who've been there from 200-300 years ago. I have a great night's sleep. I'm impervious to ghosts because I'm used to living in airports, I suppose. But the Japanese have a really acute reverence for ghosts. And I think those of us who go from a relatively young society to an old society like that are sometimes going in search of ghosts and in search of what they bespeak, which is a connection with the heavens, a connection with ancestors and the past, a due deference to everything that's enormous in us. I think in any Japanese work of art, the individuals are tiny, the empty space is huge, and the mountains or the seasons are the real protagonist. And I think ghost stories fit into that. That Japanese feel that ghosts have been around for hundreds or thousands of years and they have been around only for 30, 40 years. And by the kind of mystery I was just talking about in answer to the gentleman's earlier question, the very first day I set foot in Kyoto happened to be the time of the Obon Festival when there were lanterns set up all along the hills to lead departed spirits and ghosts back to their former homes. And as I was thinking about it last week, I was thinking, who knows? You know, it sounds like I was a ghost. There I was. There are only 3 days of the year when the whole city is illuminated because ghosts come back and revisit their still living family members. And there was I visiting Kyoto for the first time.
That's beautiful. In having started this book over 8 years ago and having written several thousand pages, and I imagine changing yourself during that same eight-year period. How did you decide what to edit, and at what point did you decide to go in one direction and not the other, and did you ever regret the road not taken?
Wonderful question. Thank you. And in some ways, I'm still working on this book. I refuse to let it go, partly because I don't want to let Green go. I gladly would continue reading him and writing about him for the rest of my life, and 4 days ago in my hotel room, I was rewriting passages of it for the paperback edition, and that will probably go on indefinitely. And in terms of the road not taken, whenever I pick out some of those pages from the closet, the rejected pages, and I read them, I think, this is so much more alive and interesting than anything in the book. But it didn't necessarily fit. And, you know, that's one of the interesting things, whether you're writing a symphony or making a movie or doing a collage, that Faulkner famously said, you have to kill your darlings. You take the passages that you most love and throw those out because they're perhaps too loud. It's like if you're creating a dinner party and somebody comes in dressed in an orange bikini, it's going to be very hard for the thing to proceed well. You need everyone to harmonize to some degree. And so a piece that was too striking, a passage was too striking, I would throw out because it would tilt the very, very delicate balance. And I think I tried to leave it to intuition a lot, and I never actually got it quite right. But Tom read out that passage about writing being a performance. And any time I would write a passage, and as most of us do, when I wrote it, it seemed inspiration, sent from heaven, illumination. And then 4 months later, I'd say, this is a terrific passage, but there's something fake about it. Or I'm trying to make an impression, or I'm trying to persuade myself or somebody else of something. And so however good it was, I would try to keep it out, and just push precisely to those places I didn't want to go to, and even to those passages I was uncomfortable with. And I think I was grateful to my editor, who was always in some ways pushing me to write about what I didn't write about, what I didn't want to write about, knowing that that is really where the rich material is, and indeed that if you're too much in command of the material, it's not material that's live enough. But I do have any number of regrets, but somehow the first 70 pages of this, I never really got to my satisfaction. And the final 170, which is very much a collage, because what I was trying to do was put 15 totally disparate objects on a floor like this and see what energy the sparks struck up between them. A doesn't bear any relation to Q and D, they're seemingly randomly collected, but to me they made an intuitive, logical sense. And Louise said something lovely in her introduction about how this is non-deductive narrative, that in deference to Green, I didn't think I should write an ABC narrative or a QED. I thought AQD or AZN or whatever. And so I set the final 170 pages are pretty much like that. This initial 70 I never got right. But since the book came out, most of my readers seem to have enjoyed the first 70 much more, which is a reminder that actually the more unsettled and maybe unfinished the work is, sometimes the better it could be. And that's one of the things you learn from your readers, and it's a great gift that they give you by showing you all the things you'd never be able to see in 1,000 years at the desk.
And that said, my experience of the book is that while the opening has a lot of wonderful moments, there's a certain momentum where I guess is where the craft sort of takes over. So you begin with sort of the raw material, mm-hmm. but as you approach the end of the book, the momentum in the final sequence between your father's death and this rather crazed drive in Bolivia is just, it's harrowing, and it's really quite quick and quite compelling.
So, thank you. Well, the momentum is a large part of it. And you said the craft takes over.
And
I guess
craft,
that's just what I hoped would happen, that I would surrender and something else would create a pattern much better than any I could rationally devise. But when I hear the word craft, I also think, well, there's a virtue in not having the craft.
Exactly. The performance is a double-edged sword. You want it, and yet you don't want it.
First off, thank you for a very interesting and stimulating conversation. Secondly, in regards to fire being a metaphor in your writing, I have some familiarity with the Sufi literature where fire works as a cleansing tool. It's very much related to the step of annihilation. I was wondering if you have, what's your take on it, or if you even agree with that premise?
Thank you. Another wonderful question. I wrote a book about Sufism a few years ago, and the epigraph, as in this book, was from Thoreau, and it was, "Fire is the most tolerable third party." And as I was listening to Tom talk about fire, I thought, again, I could have used "fire is the most tolerable third party" as the epigraph for this book, or the sub-theme for this book. And I noticed when I was talking this evening, I talked a lot about submission, surrender, which is Islam. That's the meaning of the word. And so when I was writing about Sufism, I was probably writing about many of the same things as in this book, because whether it's Buddhist meditation or Christian mysticism, which is in here, or Sufism, I think they're all about surrender to fire, maybe.
Interesting.
Thank you so much. You've written elsewhere a little bit about your relationship with your father, and you hinted at it today. What are the parallels with you and Green on that front, if any?
Yes, I've been reading Graham Greene for 40 years, and if you'd asked me 10 years ago, does he write about fathers, I'd have said no. He was not a very good father in real life, and his own parents and household, because he wasn't a very domestic soul, never seemed to hold much interest for him. And yet, of course, as I was writing this book and rereading Graham Greene, it seemed to be he was only writing about fathers and sons. And book after book after book, he's writing about a lost boy wandering through a city trying to find his father. He mentions that many of his most haunting dreams after his own father's death were his father coming back to him and his understanding his father for the first time, though belatedly. The Quiet American, which is the novel of his I most concentrate on, about a middle-aged Englishman and a young American in Havana, in Saigon in the 1950s, I suddenly see as a father and son story, which is why they don't know how much to love one another and how much to compete against one another, but it's why the feeling between them is so intense. So now I see that impulse very strongly in him. And I must say that a little to my sorrow, my publishers put a picture of my father and me on the cover of this book, and I rather wish they hadn't, because anybody picking up this book hoping to read about my father or me will be a little disappointed. Because there's not so much really about the details of our lives, but I was interested in that archetypal, again, pattern that every male in this room surely knows, which is that when you're growing up, the way to define yourself is to run away from home, to create your own destiny, to turn your back on everything you associate with your parents. And then 30 years later, you look in the mirror or you hear your own voice and it's something very familiar because you've become your father. You rebel against your parents until you become them. And the same, I think, with daughters and their mothers often. I was thinking on the plane down here that if I were courting a woman and I said to her, "You look just like your mother," she'd slam the door on me, I think. It'd be the end of the courtship. But if I said to her, you look just like Virginia Woolf, even if Virginia Woolf was less attractive and charismatic than her mother, she would probably brighten to that suggestion. So we all live with that double standard. We're determined not to be like our parents, though our blood and DNA and everything about us condemns us more or less to become them. And we're very keen to attach themselves and to pretend to be like Graham Greene, who's such a cool romantic figure because I've never met him. And so the very fact of exploring why I create this father in my head, Graham Greene, or this shadow father, or literary godfather, the very process of exploring that forces me to ask, what about the father who created me, and why was he not good enough for me? So while not going into many of the details of his life or my life, I was interested in how that pattern plays out in all of us, probably.
Well, at this point, yeah, this is a good way to end it. Thank you, Pico. There's going to be a book signing out in the lobby. You'll have a chance to meet Pico up close and personal.
Allowed is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Allowed theme was composed by Larry Karish.